This podcast contains explicit material. Listener discretion is advised. Hi, and welcome to The Joy of Text, a podcast about Judaism and sexuality. After many requests from listeners, in this episode, we will be talking about having a discussion about sex with your children. We will then be joined by Dr. Joy Layden to discuss transsexuality in the Orthodox and Jewish communities. Finally, we will answer more listener questions. And stay tuned after the listener question for an in-depth text study with Rabbi Linzer. With me to discuss are Dr. Batsheva Marcus, the clinical director of the Medical Center for Female Sexuality, the largest center of its kind in the U.S., and a founding member of JOFA, the Jewish Orthodox Feminist Alliance, and Rabbi Dov Linzer, the Rosh Yeshiva Rabbinic Dean of Yeshivat Chovevei Torah Rabbinical School, the premier modern Orthodox rabbinical school with close to 100 rabbis in the field that is setting the standard in rabbinic education. My name is Rami Smith, and I just finished my studies at Yeshivat Maharat. Dr. Marcus, why are we so afraid to teach kids about sex?
I don't know. I think people are still really uncomfortable talking about sex. I think people will couch it in, I don't know that I want my kids to know about sex, but I think what it really comes down to is people, even though they believe they're comfortable talking about sex, may be a little less comfortable than they think they are. And sort of my classic always is when I'm giving classes on this, and I love giving classes on this, so there's a shout out if anybody has a community that wants to bring me in to talk to parents about talking to their kids about sex, I'm happy to do that. One of the things that I always find with parents is they say, well, I was told to answer my kids' questions, but my kids never ask any questions, right? That is the classic line. So I think in the last, in the last round of when we changed our messages about parents and talking about sex, we said, just make sure you answer their questions. And parents translated that into, I'll wait till the kids ask questions. But you can't really wait till the kids ask questions. So I can give you a very quick outline as to what ages, what should be talked about. But I'm a very, very big believer in starting like from the time the kids can talk. The same way that food is something you just talk about in your life and you don't sit down at age 15 and have a conversation with your child about food. Right? Nutrition or how to eat well or what's good for you. It's just part and parcel of your life. I feel like sex should be that way also. So I don't know why parents are afraid, but I really think with the younger ages, they're just not comfortable. I don't really think it's necessary, so they don't push themselves. And with the older ages, it gets a little more complicated. They're still not comfortable, and now they're not even clear about what their messages should be.
So I think you do know why parents don't want to talk to their kids about sex, even if you don't agree with it. And I think it's because there are a lot of people, I certainly agree that some people, they're conflicting themselves about what their message is. And probably part of that conflict, besides discomfort about talking about it, is also a conflict about what are my values and are they or are they not consistent with what I know halacha says about this matter. So I think that's definitely an issue. But I also think some people feel like, if I talk to them about it, I'm going to give them ideas.
I think that's true about why people don't want to talk to their older kids. Mm-hmm. I think that's why people don't want to talk to their older kids about sex. I absolutely think that there's some concern. But I don't really think that's why they don't call a vagina, or a vulva for a three-year-old girl. I don't think they're going to give her any ideas. Like, I don't think that's the fear.
So maybe we should stop and ask what we mean by talking to our kids about sex. About identifying like the sexual organs and where babies come from, or talking about what sex is about.
So I'm gonna throw out some sort of very, very basic guidelines. These are classic. You can find them in most books about parenting. But by ages two or three, they should know the right body parts, and they should do that without shame. And that's a great time for you as a parent to practice. Because it's much less embarrassing to say the word vulva to your 3-year-old than it might be to say it's your 14-year-old boy. So I think that's really important. From 3 to 5, sort of the basics of where babies come from. There's a uterus in there, the baby grows in the uterus, kind of that basic stuff. By ages 5 to 6, they usually are ready kind of for an idea of how babies really get inside that uterus. That there's a sperm and there's an egg. They don't necessarily need exact details of how that happens unless they specifically ask and push for it. I would say by age 6 to 8, you want to have, at that point, they, for certainly 7 to 9, let's say, they really need to start understanding intercourse, because that's already, they're watching television, their friends are talking, they need to have a kind of a basic understanding of intercourse. And I think in general,
the mechanics of it?
Yes, that a penis goes inside a vagina. That's how that happens.
7 to 9?
Yeah. And I know that sounds young, but by 9, I would say most kids have been exposed to all kinds of bizarre ideas. So they need the information. By 9, they should have that information. And above 9, which is when we're heading, honestly, into the teenage years, it's like the changes happening in their body and why that's happening, and so kind of personalize it. And I think already by age 10 or over, you should be very clear about value setting. I mean, I think value setting could go in earlier, but it's a little hard to talk about values when you talk about the fact that a baby's growing in a uterus. But for sure, when you're talking about, you know, touching each other, you know, having premarital sex, any of those conversations, that's where your values come in. And that's where I think really what you're talking about, the parents, I think, aren't very clear themselves. They say they're clear, but say to the parent, articulate to your partner out loud what your values are, what is the message you want to give your kid. And a part of them's going, want to say, don't touch anybody till you're married, you know, or, you know, you get married at 22 and you can start dating when you're 23, you know, like that sort of, I think parents are very conflicted.
Right. And about masturbation, how does that fit in, if practically in a halachic context, and about, like, do you want to talk to your kids about birth control, or are you afraid that that's, you know, giving them license, and the other hand, you know, there are some real health risks and so on. And so all of those areas, I think they're very conflicted about.
You know, so just so we keep a little bit of a focus here, let's start with that under six idea,
okay.
Right? Okay, so there, it seems to me like there'd be very few halachic issues and problems. Is that fair? Like,
yes.
I have gotten pushback sometimes when I give books, and I'll put it right out there. Robbie Harris makes a series of books for ages 4 and up, 7 and up, 10 and up. They're fabulous. It's perfectly normal. It's not the stork. Most people are familiar with them, but they're great books, and they're fabulous resource to have with your kids because you can get the book and read it with your kids.
Right.
But I got pushback from one mother who said to me, I thought it wasn't SNEAS because of the pictures, even though the pictures are all cartoons.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like, and other parents have said to me too, kids need pictures because they can't, right. You tell them things and they get the most bizarre ideas in their head about what you're talking about. So what do you think about that?
I want to say two things. First, you know, I also think that the idea of labeling and talking about body parts and the point you made that we should treat it just as normal. You want to know what your earlobe is and you want to know what, you know, what the vagina is and what the penis is and so on. I think for a lot of parents, particularly in terms of like some of the religious messages they get, they feel funny sort of normalizing it that way and talking about it as neutrally. So I think a very important text about this is the Igeret HaKodesh, which is attributed to Ramban Nachmanides. He actually isn't the author, but it's a very powerful opening statement where it says, there's nothing that God created about our body that is shameful. I mean, God created our body, so there's nothing shameful about any part of it, and that the sexual organs are just like any other part of the body, and if they're used correctly, then that's a good thing, and they can be used incorrectly as well, and hands could be used to murder, and they could be used to caress, you know, and the sexual organs could be used to rape, and they could be used to make love. So I think that, like, that is such a powerful text, A, to teach to kids at the right age, or at least to communicate that message, and B, to talk to parents about in terms about like owning that ethos, you know, and yes, there's something very powerful about the sexual part of our body and our identity and so on, and that's why it needs to be talked about, but it needs to be normalized. And in terms of the issue of images, look, we discussed last time the whole question about pornography. I mean, those are images that are created specifically for the purpose of, you know, of titillation and, you know, and similar, and, you know, creating erotic stimulation and so on. This is done for the purpose of education, and there's a general principle in halacha in many areas that some things that would be forbidden in other contexts to study about, to engage in, and so on, are permissible in an educational context. So, for example, the Gemara talks about learning about magic or learning about certain practices of idolatry or even how to say God's ineffable name. Things that are, you know, normally totally forbidden to be done can be done for the purpose of education. The language in the Gemara is Ata Lamed Lahavinu Lahorot. You can learn in order to understand and to teach. So I think that these types of pictures certainly are not non-SNEAS. You know, they're educational, number one, just in terms of their very content. They're very different than other types of images. And that, in general, something that's doing a necessary educational function, the halacha generally gives a large license to.
So the only issue, isn't it nice to have an issue we're not arguing about here? the only issue that I think may come up is the issue of little kids and masturbation. Let's talk about that. So, you know, most kids are not masturbating for orgasm at that age. Most kids are masturbating because it relaxes them. But I think that makes people really uncomfortable. And how you handle it, I feel like it has a pretty large impact on how they feel about themselves and their bodies and pleasure as they get older.
Can I interrupt and ask for clarification? So at that age, if kids at that age don't have yet sexual drives and hormones and so on, could you just explain what masturbation does do for them?
I think it just feels good. That's actually an interesting question, and I probably need to look that up more, but I think it just feels good, and it's kind of very relaxing. It's like stroking a part of themselves that feels really calm and relaxing. I think that, yeah, I mean, they may have some hormones, but not enough, certainly, to make it really sexualized. So I don't know. I mean, there is something about, I wonder if it also depends. Also, some kids pick up all kinds of like weird things that they do, right? Some kids take a blanket and rub it on their nose, what I mean? And this is a particularly sensitive part of the body that feels really good. So I don't think it's really all that different from that. Parents' response to that is kind of very different. And so again, the new normal is to say, you know, don't do that in public, sweetie, let's do that in private. Mm-hmm. But I think that has a lot to do with how you say that as well. And I feel like the subtlety of that is very important. It's one thing to say, don't do that in public, here, let's go color, or, you know, in some way make it clear to the child that you're very uncomfortable. And it's another way to say to the kid, I know that feels really good, sweetie, but that's really something we do in our bedroom, you know, or not something you really want to do in your, you know, second grade classroom or your kindergarten classroom.
Is there a follow-up to that, though? How do you explain why without having the same problem of you don't do it in public, but it's not something to be ashamed
right.
of?
Right, so that might be a good time to kind of introduce the whole idea that there are parts of our body and things that we do that feel really good that really are private things, and part of what makes them special is that they're private things. That's kind of important to do that in a private place. And then you'll have to also define for the kid what a private place is. Somebody was telling me recently, a father, that his daughter was in the bathtub, his four-year-old daughter, and she was masturbating, and she said, Daddy, I have my finger in my vagina. It feels really good. So clearly he had used the right words. And he said, okay, sweetie, but really we only do that in private. And she said, but we are in private, Daddy. Mm-hmm. So I think you need to be very clear. And again, this has to do with defining for yourself what you're comfortable with. The father is not comfortable with the daughter masturbating in front of him. He'd say, you know what, that's something you do just with your mommy or just in your bedroom or, you know. But again, that has to do with our being comfortable with it.
Right, right. Look, I think that in halacha really understands that chinuch and education is geared towards when the child is able to hear the, you know, the messages, talking about just even training them to do particular mitzvot, like when they're of the age in which they can adopt and internalize and do those practices. So a parent that might be concerned, like, well, and I'm not sure this is what you were asking, but I can imagine somebody say, like, I can't normalize touch because then it'll be like I'm saying that masturbation is okay, and I know that halacha is not okay with masturbation. I mean, that's a challenge enough when kids actually are at the age that they do want to be masturbating sexually, and how to give over a type of a message that, you know, that is in line with halacha and in line with the parent's values and so on. But at this age, it's like you're going to have plenty of time to talk about halacha attitude towards masturbation. That is completely not relevant for this child at this time. And actually, the messages that you can send by, like, slapping the hand or whatever are going to be so harmful for the child's, you know, well-being in terms of their own future sexual development and sense of sexuality and so on. So the mandate of chinuch, of educating the kid right now, is about how to create a healthy attitude towards, you know, one's body and one's sexuality. So I completely agree that we can't worry about, like, am I going to be seeing, like,
future
I'm giving
use.
Future, exactly.
Yeah.
Seeing, giving some license to future, you know, saying that there's no problem with masturbation according to halacha.
This sounds like an ethic that we've kind of been discussing throughout the podcast. We talked about it in terms of condoms. We don't want to talk about condoms because then kids might feel it's okay to wear condoms. We don't want to normalize body parts because then it might go to a place where people are too comfortable with it. And that seems to be kind of a pattern that repeats throughout various places. So I wonder how we can address that.
Yeah.
I think that's a great sort of segue into the next age group, which is when we're talking about like 8 or 9 and up, when I really do think you should be talking about sort of very concrete sexual issues with these kids. And I feel like, and I think is what you're saying, Raimi, tell me if I'm wrong, that somehow if we talk about it, they're going to act on it.
Yeah.
Right. And we, you know, that came up with pornography, that came
exactly.
up with, right. But I will say yet again, the statistics do not suggest that. The statistics suggest that the more you educate kids, the later they start being active. Even the situations where the activity is the same, they're better educated about it. So there's less disease, there's less abortion, there's just, nobody has been able to produce evidence that suggests that the more you talk about something, the more
people act on it.
But I will tell you that by those ages, that sort of like middle school, pre-high school years, the amount of information they're getting from the television, their friends, the playground is just astonishing. Kids, even kids that you think are pretty sheltered.
Right.
So that becomes the age where you really kind of need to explain things to them. And I feel like you never want to sit down and have a talk. Like, That embarrasses you. It embarrasses the kids. It's just uncomfortable. You don't have the talk. You have many talks over the course of your kid's life, and you use every opportunity. And the irony is, I feel like the Jewish texts give you so much opportunity to talk about that when they're learning Mishnah or when they're learning Chumash. Like, there's just so many great opportunities to, like, do you not know what that is? Let me explain to you what that is. You know, here's what's happening. And if you do it with very regular, like, I feel like going to the mikvah, we talked about that. There's like a million places in which you can bring in your sort of sexual ideas and, you know, that this is a wonderful thing and it's something that you wait till you have a permanent relationship with. But again, you have to define for yourself really clearly. Like, I want a teenager. Do I want my teenager really not touching anybody till they're married? And I know that's, you know, a halachic issue, but again, these parents have to define for themselves. Like, really, I don't think you should be in any kind of physical relationship until you're in a stable emotional relationship. That's a clear, and what does that mean? Is that with somebody for 6 months, 3 months? Like, kids might not listen to you, but at least they'll have some idea of what you think, as opposed to, like, my mother doesn't really want me to do anything until I'm married. Like, that would be what most kids would say, because nobody's told them otherwise.
Right. Look, I think that something I hear, not so much in the non-Orthodox community, but it's a similar conflict that parents have about talking to their kids about drugs. Like, okay, I did something when I was in college and high school, but I don't want my kids to do what I did, or I'm not exactly sure, because was it really so bad that I smoked a little pot? And, like, because they're so conflicted about their own values and what message and what they think is a message that will be heard and adopted, they don't talk about it at all.
Also, I think this is beyond those values. It's also an education. If I wasn't taught about sex, how do I teach my kid about sex?
Right. But the drug analogy is a great one, because if you could talk about it, you can also talk about your experience. Like, or you, if you don't want to talk about your experience, you can certainly talk about, you can educate them. You can educate them. You can use it as an education. Education values should be, you know, running hand in hand.
Right.
I'm rubbing my hands together, but nobody can see that.
I mean, I'm wondering if there's if something out there to help parents, meaning is it enough to tell parents you need to talk to your kids? A lot of parents need the language, and they need, you know, how to say things and how to articulate them. And they also need, whether it's about education or whether it's about values, but they also need to go through a process of helping them clarify their own values on it, you know, and I'm not sure what can give them that access to clarify for themselves what their own values are.
I think that's why what you said, Dr. Marcus, about educating parents is so important, because sex education starts with, obviously, with parents, but it seems like in a lot of communities, parents need to be educated before they can be educating their own children.
Right. Again, what I'm talking about is not just education, but it's going through a process of sort of self-reflection and clarification about what do you really think about this?
I guess, you know, to me that goes along with education.
Right.
Like, especially in like a Jewish or halachic context, it seems like the education should come along with a values piece.
Right.
The only thing is that sometimes I feel like the education piece tends to be passive. You know, they listen, they take it in, as opposed to actually having to own it, which people sort of think they do, but then when they get down to it, they don't really do it. But I'm actually curious, like, at those age groups, when you're talking about, let's say, intercourse, you're talking about homosexuality, you're talking about oral sex, or you're having those conversations, does that present a tsniut issue?
So I don't know as much tsniut. I think I would say what I said before about the tsnius question. You know, it's education, it's not a tsnius problem, and so on. I do want to go back to the point about, like, people's concern about, you know, will it encourage people acting on it? Because I do think, A, people have that concern, and yes, I certainly have seen about this issue. We were talking recently, there was a little interesting clip a few months ago on Jon Stewart where they were talking to, I think, high school kids that weren't getting any sex education, and they were demanding sex education. And again, it was just so obvious about how parents had no, like, they would ask teachers very concrete questions, and the teachers had, like, no knowledge to give them, and that the process of sort of learning more about it actually reduced their sexual activity and reduced, you know, and so on. So, but back to the point. So I think that there's one question that people are concerned about, is that will it lead to them actually engaging in activity? But there's another concern that I've heard from a lot of religious parents, which is that it's going to, you know, they're going to lose their innocence. It's going to corrupt their mind. It's going to fill them with ideas and images. Even if they're not going to act on it, I don't want my kid to be thinking about those things. And here, I think that the biggest point to be made is what you said before, which is, for God's sake, they are so exposed to that stuff. Like, we could have had an argument 20 years ago, before the internet, whether maintaining innocence was a better thing or not, right? But, like, that ship has sailed, you know? There's just so much negative and bad and misinformation, bad values out there. There's like a profound mandate right now to be proactive and to, you know, communicate good values and the education and the accurate information. So I think the issue of innocence, and also this question about, like, will it give them ideas? They're getting so many ideas from other sources that, like, that was a more relevant question 20 years ago than I think we can even get off the ground right now.
You know, as I'm listening to you, though, I also want to challenge this idea of innocence. Everything you said is 100% correct, but I want to challenge this idea of innocence. First of all, I don't think kids are as innocent as we think they are. I think that's a very Victorian idea that kind of got adopted. But also, is that a good thing? Like, when you say they're innocent, that means they don't know about certain things. But if we think these things are nice things and good things, is that necessary? Like, why is, when you talk about innocence, think what the subtext is. Like, they're spiritual and holy because they don't know anything about sex. But that isn't our whole value. Our whole value is, do you get what I'm saying?
I want to add on to the question by saying, in the Jewish text, there's a lot of not naming of body parts. And I wonder how that kind of adds to that value. Maybe I shouldn't say that question better. But, you know, just the fact that, like, the Jewish text uses the word makom, like a place, instead of an anatomically correct body part. So that maybe points to, like,
is there a word? Like, I always, when it says hamakom, I feel like there aren't words for those body parts.
That's what I'm saying. I'm saying the word is makom. Like, isn't named.
And it should be pointed out that some Rishonim say that the reason Hebrew is called Lashon HaKodesh is because it does not have explicit terms for the body parts. So so that just reinforces, you would have to capture on the podcast. So I think that that's a really good point.
Was the Hasidim who said that?
No. I think it's, I'm trying to remember, it's one of the Rishonim says that.
Well, I feel like that's a very sad message.
Yeah, so I think that, look, I mean, you know, what we are talking about in a way, it's been like an ongoing, I think, tension that's been from day one in this podcast, is Judaism really grapples with the power of sexuality, right? It's such this powerful force. I before quoted the Ramban in the Gerach HaKod, it says, there's nothing shameful about it. It's a powerful force, could be used for good, could be used for bad. But, you know, in a religious context where you're supposed to be sort of focusing on more elevated things, and you deal with this powerful force that could, you know, lead to a very type of a sensual engagement, could control your life rather than you control it, there's something that can be very potentially conflictual about sexuality, right? I mean, you know, in some religions, the idea would be to ascetic and to be completely non-sexual. So the question is, like, that leads to, I would say, fundamentally two camps, you know, within the Jewish tradition. One that says, yes, this is fundamentally a problematic thing, but we can make it kosher, or it will become kosher in very particular contexts, within marriage, whatever. But it starts, our first orientation is it's problematic. How do we get it into the context where it's going to be kosher? And that approach would also say that sex should be primarily about procreation, you know, because we have to do something to make it kosher. And then there's another approach which says no, like, you know, in some contexts it's problematic, in other contexts it's kosher and wonderful and elevated, and you don't have to make something bad, you don't have to kosher it up, you don't have to, you know, transform it. It's powerful in the right, and good and beautiful in the right context, and it's problematic in the wrong context.
And it can elevate your life to a different experience.
Exactly.
As well.
And, you know, and this approach says, you know, marital sex doesn't have to be about procreation. The power of bringing two human beings together is this power of sexuality, which is this amazing thing that God has given us, right? Yes, in other contexts, it's bad. So I think that that's part of
how that could get relayed. I guess the second camp of it being a good, beautiful thing in certain contexts, when just the basics seem to not point to that by, like, not using certain language or starting with the assumption that
it's funny because on the one hand it doesn't use certain language, on the other hand I feel like the Torah and the Gemara are, like, very upfront about a lot of sexual things, you know, like, right. They don't hide it, they don't use good language, but maybe one could argue, and this is like far out, that it's so central and so important that it is the place, you know, it's like, you know, the force, may the force be with you, you know, it's like, so it's probably a stretch, I grant you that that's probably a stretch, but I do think that, I don't feel like the Gemara and the Torah is particularly, like, subversive when it comes to talking about sex.
I didn't mean that.
No.
I just meant in the context of education to bring in Jewish sources, especially, I know you're, Dr. Marcus, a very big advocate of using proper names. So how do you take the Jewish text, even if it is, this place is so holy, it's the place, and bring it into an actual education where you want to not be relaying that language of your place, you want to be using a correct body part.
Well, can I jump in here? Because I think another way of talking about the non-explicit language is that we don't want to make sex just about body parts, right? I mean, we want to make it about two people coming together. And to start, like you say in the Torah, where it says, you know, and Adam knew Chava, his wife, what does it mean that to know somebody is being identified with the sexual act, right? That is such a powerful message to begin with, right? What does that do to connect two human beings. So sure, there are anatomical parts that are part of it, but you know, we're not going to describe, you also use your hands during sex, you know, we're not going to focus on the hands when we're talking about what sex is about. So I think that there's, I mean, on the one hand, you don't want to hide it and become shameful or whatever, but I think that there's a power in talking about, you know, not a hyper-focus on the particular organs and body parts as what sex is about in terms of the values and the message, as opposed to just knowing technically, practically, how the pieces fit together. I mean, and I do also want to say about the Jewish texts, and I want to talk about this in terms of education. We have no problem, I think we should have a problem, but we have no problem in like teaching 12-year-old boys, tends to be boys, Masechet Ketuvot, where the first chapter is about, can a man have sex with his wife for the first time on Shabbat, and discusses in detail the act of penetrating the vagina and ripping the hymen and the blood coming out, and is that a problem on Shabbat? Right? And there's so many other issues there beyond just, you know, the graphic nature of that discussion in terms of, you know, the woman is the sort of an object in that and the man is the sort of actor and so on. But nevertheless, that's okay. We can teach him because it's Torah. Well, you know what? There's a Torah about teaching, about an educational Torah in Jewish values to teach about the body parts just for its own sake, about knowing those body parts. So I don't understand why we're okay about teaching it in the context of a page of Gemara, but not in another type of a context.
But also, I think this comes back to a discussion we had in episode 6 about learning about sex through porn versus porn being used in other contexts. Learning about sex through Masechet Ketubot also has like a value and an ethic about,
right,
about what sex is and what a woman is and what virginity is. And
I'd rather learn
really
about it.
Is that really the place to start the education?
I agree. I said I think it is problematic. Yeah. But I'd much rather learn about sex through the first two chapters of Bereishit, you know? But if we can allow ourselves to say, oh, it's okay, not every time we talk about sex and body parts does it have to be a problem. So I actually think that we could do a much better, you know, a primary job of religious education and parental responsibility of education and talking about these issues directly.
So I'm going to use both those examples. I think they're great examples to say this is where the parent has to be involved. You know, if you see your child watching television, if you see your child learning Masechet of Gemara, if you see your child learning Bereishit, if you see your child watching some porn, like, I'm not equating those two. Really, I'm not. But all I'm saying is if the parents can insert themselves at that point and say, oh, what do you think of this? Here's my thinking on this. Here's where I think that, you know, this makes a lot of sense to me, and this I have questions about, you know. And I feel like, and I'm going to sort of drag us a little bit back to this idea of like parents talking to their kids. You know, I feel like parents feel like there's like a wall. And I would argue with you, whatever your kids are asking or what they're exposed to, you should be talking about it, and you should try to talk to them about it as comfortably as you can, because that's your opportunity to insert your values, exactly what we're saying. So I was giving a lecture on talking to your kids about sex, and one of the mother raised her hands, and she said, you know, that's all fine and good when you're talking about intercourse, but she said, my 11-year-old came home and asked me what a threesome was. Should I have explained to him what a threesome was? And, you know, it did. Of course you should explain to him what a threesome was. Like, he's heard about it. He now knows what it is. This is your opportunity. You may not forget another one to talk about your feelings regarding sex between more than two individuals. So if, you know, we get nervous, again, either it's because we think it's going to play out or because the whole idea just makes us so nervous. And I think it's really the latter. But this is your opportunity to say, yeah, honey, sometimes people choose to have sex with more than one person. They have like sex with two or more people. I don't particularly think that's a good value. And here's why I don't think it's a good value. And here's how maybe I think about it. And I think you can do that in every one of these cases. But in order to do that, you have to have laid a foundation where you're really comfortable talking to your kids, that your kids will listen to you. I do know parents often say, like kids say, too much information. I don't want to hear mom. You know, I don't want to hear dad. And so what I often say is, like, often in a place where you're not necessarily looking at the person, like if you're driving a car, that's a good time to have a conversation. You're in the breakfast, you're making eggs or something, you're not necessarily looking at the child. Those are really good opportunities. And you're talking about a few sentences, throwing in a few sentences, they'll hear you. That does not mean sitting down. But I feel like all of these opportunities, when your kids ask about threesomes, when your kid is learning a masechet of Mishnah or Gemara that you think has values that you may not approve of or they approve of, you know, when your kid's watching something on television, like any of those are great openings, and you should be kind of available and looking for those openings.
Right, and I want to jump in. I mean, first of all, the obvious point also is, are you communicating comfort or discomfort? Because you could feel like, okay, check, I've had the talk, but you communicate really a lot of discomfort, you know. So I think that also the energy and the, you know, and the comfort and discomfort that you communicate is very critical. I also think that parents aren't aware of the unintended consequences of, you know, the fact that they're not going to talk about it. Oh, threesomes, let's shut that down. If I shut down the conversation, the kid won't think about it, and it won't be a possibility, and I'll save them from, you know, from having those thoughts? Well, obviously, first of all, if you shut something down, it becomes forbidden and off limits. Of course, it makes it just all that much more attractive and interesting and something that they want to find out about. So, you know, if you don't want to talk about something, it makes it off limits. And, you know, there's like this phrase, right? Stolen waters are sweet, right? Mayim genuvim yimtaku. As soon as something is forbidden and off limits and something not to be talked about, it makes, you know, makes them very intrigued by it. But the other thing is that it communicates a broader message than you were thinking. You were thinking somehow that you were sort of saying, like, that's bad, and that's what gets communicated. But I think in some ways, and Batsheva, you sort of, I'd like to hear what you think about it, what really gets communicated is sex is bad. All of this conversation is bad. And that leads
or
to...
I can't talk about it. I think I can't discuss this with you.
And then what do you think?
You can't be open.
And you therefore can't talk to me about these issues.
Right. And you might also be communicating that sex is bad, but...
I feel that I've spoken to people, and again, I don't know, I'm sure, right. Like, I don't know if there's studies about this, but people who felt that these conversations were off limits with their parents, that basically the values that they received about this was not, oh, sex is a good thing between two people in marriage. The value that they got out of it was like, sex is something that's embarrassing, shameful, not to be talking about, problematic. They got a lot of negative values by the fact that parents didn't want to talk about what's a threesome or any question.
So on top of that feeling, they still want to know, so they're going to go find somewhere else, and either they're going to learn about it on the bus or on the, Googling
exactly.
It, or it's an opportunity.
And then they can get some pictures, and then they'll get pictures and a video
probably,
of it if they want.
Yeah, Googling threesomes probably way worse.
You know, it's so funny. I always think about this when I was in, I think, fifth or sixth grade, I don't remember. I was in school, and something came up about having a baby, and I don't remember how it happened, but I said, well, I know how you have the baby, you davened Hashem, which is exactly what my parents had told me. So ironic, though this may be. I hope they're listening to this podcast. And the girl behind me started laughing. I remember her name, Myra Brodsky. And she started laughing, and she said, that is not how you have a baby. And during recess, she then explained to me how you have a baby. And I, you know, obviously, that was really just not a good experience. I remember it now. I'm 53 years old, and I still remember it. And I feel like you want to be the ones to talk to your kids. You don't want your kids to be the ones kind of in the dark that doesn't have any information. I don't think... When you talk about innocence, I don't think that's a good thing. Like, right. That wasn't a good thing.
Right.
Do you know what I mean? Like,
right.
You know, understanding that davening to Hashem is a part of it. And I do think that davening to Hashem is a part of having a baby. Yeah. Because, you know, we give our kids messages like, make sure you use birth control before you have sex. And then the message they get on the opposite is, the minute I have sex without birth control, I'm going to get pregnant, which is also a total misconception. I can tell you lots of women who thought they were going to get pregnant. They had planned their pregnancy for, you know, age 23 and 4 months. And, you know, lo and behold, it didn't happen right away. So I think God has to be part of the equation. I really do. But parents are doing themselves a much bigger favor and doing their kids a favor if they kind of explain how it works and then say, and God has a piece in this also.
Right.
You know, like, I feel like, and that gets left out too.
So you say that, you know, innocence isn't a good thing, but I'm thinking about the parents who say, I don't want to get a message home from the teacher. Dear Mr. and Mrs. Marcus, you know, your daughter, I wouldn't make it about you. but anyway, you know, your son or your daughter was explaining to the whole class about naming all the body parts and showing on their bodies and doing a whole little demonstration for the class, right?
See, I don't see what's so wrong with that. Only
well, the demonstration, maybe.
I had a similar experience that you had, that I also was told a baby comes from Hashem. If you're listening to this, Mom,
really, and look at our
Sorry,
age difference.
But I remember so distinctly that I came home from school and I told my mom, "Where does a baby come from?" And she said, Hashem puts it in your tummy. And I said, well, Talia says it comes from a vagina. And my mom was like, okay, thanks. But I got the education somewhere else. And then I think, I don't remember if at that point we had that conversation, but I think it's okay to learn from other kids, because even then you can still take that conversation.
No, but that's not my point. My point is that the reason parents are reluctant to
afraid.
Talk about kids, and it's like, you know, what are they going to say in the marketplace?
Okay.
Oh, I have to go with, you know, they'll start naming body parts, or in class, they'll be the student that's teaching all the other
students. I need to interject here, because I have very strong feelings about this. I had a friend who I thought was like a really with it, strong feminist, whatever, said, I would never teach my son the word penis, because I'm afraid in the supermarket he's going to say, my penis hurts.
Right.
And I'm like, okay, so what is the matter with that? Like, we have to get past that. Like, the worst is that somebody will think that you gave your kid accurate body parts, and
right.
The people who don't think that may learn something from it. So that's number one. Number two, I'm going to do a plug now for a book, which I think is amazing, called Everything You Never Wanted Your Kids to Know About Sex. I do not remember the name of the authors. I love that book. I always joke around that the only thing I don't like about that book is that I did not write that book. But it's written very general, like how to talk to your kids at different ages about what, and it has very broad range. Like, if you're more religious and you feel like you want to communicate this, then you might want to say this. And if you are, you know, not so religious, or you're, you know, God isn't a piece of it, you might want to communicate this. It gives a kind of a broad range, which I love. But one of the pieces of the book, Raimi just Googled it, Justin Richardson.
Oh, and Mark Schuster.
But what I want to say is that somewhere in that book, he talks about the fact that parents say they're afraid. Exactly what you said, Dove. Parents are afraid that, oh my God, and then my kid's going to be telling everybody about sex. And then, but when he's in a big audience, he said, can you please raise your hand if you're afraid that everybody else is going to get upset? And a lot of people raise their hand. And then he said, okay, now raise your hand if you would be upset if your kid actually was told by a friend and got accurate information. And nobody raised their hand, which is exactly what you're saying, Raimi, right? Like, if your kid's friend gives them accurate information, you know what? They give them accurate information. You should be doing it. If you didn't do it yet, then, you know, then that's great. If your kid tells you that, that's a great opening for you to say, oh, yeah, that's how it works. You do want to see some pictures and some books, and let's talk about, again, let's put some God into this equation. You know, like, again, it's your way to make it into a...
Can I just ask a question about the books? I know that there are a lot of books that are made. I mean, many girls receive like a period and your body is changing book. Are these the kind of things, especially with younger kids, that parents should be giving to their children and having the child explore it themselves, or sitting down with their kid and having a conversation with them?
So with the little kids, for the little kids, I would say under even 10, depending on how, on your own child, I'd give them the books that say, this is a really interesting book. Do you want me to read it with you? Often a younger kid will be exposed to an older kid's book. That's fine. They'll get it or they won't get it. You know, I'd very much encourage reading with the kids until 6, 7, 8, really depending on your child. Once the kid hit like pre-adolescence, adolescence, they're going to be a little queasy about reading these books with you. Some of them might be fine. You might, you know, again, it depends on your child. I would absolutely buy these books and give them to your daughter or your son. I could put on the website, actually, a list of a bibliography for parents. I would give them the book, and I'd say, listen, if you have any questions about it. And then if something comes up, you can say, oh, can you pull out that book because I want to show you. Mm-hmm. You know, if she gets a urinary tract infection or something, you know, you want to sort of, you know, explain that. So I'd hand them the books, and I'd just encourage them to ask questions about it. I always have the funny story that when my daughter turned that age, my kids are going to kill me because they're in these podcasts, but when my daughter turned that age, she, you know, she grew up in my house, obviously, and I felt like she felt like she knew everything. Like, she just felt like she knew everything.
I can't imagine why.
Exactly. So, but I didn't feel like she knew everything, because there's some stuff I talk about and some stuff I didn't talk about, and I feel like she had a right to know, but I felt like if I gave her a book, she'd be insulted. So I handed her 4 books at this point. I was creating the bibliography, and I said, look, I'm looking for a good book for teenage girls. Can you look through these 4 books, and can you tell me which one do you think speaks to you the best, and sort of give me a review of the books? So that worked great, although now she's, in retrospect, she said she totally saw through it. But the truth is, it was actually very helpful to me, because there were 2 books that she thought were good. They're on my bibliography, and 2 that she thought were less good. So again, I just feel like it's part of a conversation, give them books.
One last thought about, though, the talking about body parts in public, because, Batseva, you have no problem naming body parts, right? And I have to say, you know, in this podcast, we go ahead and I name them, and, you know, I name them generally because I think, gets back to an earlier discussion, that the not naming of them and the hemming and the hawing communicates such a sense of, like, shame and discomfort around, you know, around sex and around the body that has to be counteracted. But that being said, in terms of the norms of larger society, people don't want to talk in the supermarket about body parts, right? I mean, even when you talk, you might want to, but I don't think that other people...
I disagree with you. You think it's so much better for a boy to say, my wee-wee hurts
no,
or
let's not talk
than
about
my
the boy.
Penis?
I'm talking about the words people are expecting to hear in a supermarket. I don't care from whom. Meaning, if you're talking to somebody specifically about sexual issues, I'm talking to somebody about them, we're going to name body parts, right? But I don't think people in a supermarket, there's certain words they're not expecting to hear, and there's certain conventions of society, and I think
we're
that,
trying to
wait, no, but I think that, but
like,
I think
so
what
they
it gets to,
let me just finish.
I think it gets to trying to walk this thin line between private and intimate, you know, and being that that's an ethos that we have about this, as opposed to shameful, which is, you know, very easily one type of a message can slide into the other. And I think that, like, yeah, people don't want to hear those things because those are things that are talked about in certain contexts and they're not talked about in public, and not because it's shameful, but because it's something that is more intimate and private.
What's the difference then between a kid saying my wee-wee hurts and my penis hurts if neither are things that should be addressed?
Because if I hear your kid say my penis hurts, I'm saying, oh, so Raimi has not taught her child that issues around sexuality and body parts or whatever is something that's for private. That, you know, the child thinks that that's a part of a public
I
discourse.
totally
discourse.
Disagree.
But then what does a different word communicate? It's the same problem.
Right,
so you
words,
might as well be using the right
you could say, don't,
body part.
Don't tell me something hurts in public. I mean, that's what you're saying? Like, my vagina hurts, right? My vagina hurts. So you don't want to hear that. So it would be better if she said, my bottom hurts, something hurts me down there. Like, I disagree with you. I feel like.
Or she doesn't words, say it so loud that everybody hears.
Okay, so you.
Yeah, I don't see.
Meaning, if
I
you're
don't
in a subway,
if you're in a subway
and you're talking to your friend about something, and it got to talking about something of that part of your body, would you be doing it in everybody's earshot?
But I don't know if it's. But I don't see what the difference is in language. It sounds like a volume problem, not a language
okay,
problem.
I would agree.
You know, like what's the
but
difference?
That's the problem. But kids don't learn the volume issue.
So what
they
you,
don't
so
learn.
What are you projecting? You don't give
so
them. So that they don't use them in a supermarket?
I don't know what, I'm not trying to suggest a different, I agree with everything that's been said. I'm trying to tell you where people's anxiety comes from. If my kid is going to lecture to the class about the body parts, if my kid is going to talk in a loud voice in the supermarket about the body parts, people are going to hear, you know, Rabbi Linzer has not taught his kids that that's about a private type of a thing and that this is something that's
laugh.
A public type
I
of
disagree.
Thing.
I think they'll laugh. I think they'll laugh. And they'll just as likely, they're just as likely to say, thank God somebody's using correct body parts as, you know, running around using ridiculous euphemisms. So they're just as likely to do that. They may get uncomfortable because people get uncomfortable when people yell the word penis, right? And you might want to lean down to your son and say, listen, sweetie, can you just tell me that a little quieter? People get nervous around us.
People get nervous around us when
you're screaming the word penis.
Right.
Totally. But I don't think that, right. But I,
so I guess
but
that's the thing
that,
I'm saying.
That,
and I think that that's
a problem.
Back
okay, so that's
the parent's
great.
Feelings because as a parent, if you are a parent that has conveyed discomfort with that word, then that comes off in public.
Right, but so that's the hard part. The hard part is, and that's what I'm getting before, and it's a hard part in general about us talking about sex, is talking about the difference between private and intimate, but not shameful. And for some people, if it's something that you don't talk about in a loud voice in public, that translates into shame. And I think that, I guess what I'm saying is that how much, when you talk to parents about talking to your kids about sex, you should talk to them about the body part, but you know what you should also talk to them about? Talk to them about, because these are body parts that we, you know, we do certain things in private, we show them in private, whatever, we have a convention in society that we, you know, that we talk about these things more quietly. We don't talk about them, you know, in a loud voice in public. That's a harder message to communicate, but that is actually a value that we believe in.
Okay, so I would disagree slightly. So I think parents have to, again, decide for themselves what they're comfortable with.
Right.
I personally, and I think a lot of people I know, would not have a problem at all with the kid. I might start laughing because, like, I wouldn't expect it. But in other words, if the kid started yelling, like saying, you know, my vulva hurts, you know, my vulva hurts.
Right.
So I think the odds of it happening are minimal enough that I think it's a value that I don't necessarily need to say to them. Those are words we whisper. Especially when they're very little. I don't think there's anything shameful about those words. In other words, now shameful, I know you don't think shameful either, but I don't even think there's anything that's so private about those words. Why is vulva more private than your ear? I definitely understand why sexual intercourse is a more private activity that you want to do in your own private place. But I would argue that why are we putting all that on the words, like those named body parts? So that's how I feel. But again, I would respect a parent if a parent says, listen, sweetie, just be a little careful because sometimes when you yell penis or you tell vulva or you yell vagina, it makes, and I wouldn't necessarily tell my child that it makes people a little uncomfortable because then you know the kid is going to go to the supermarket and do it on purpose. You know it, right?
Right,
exactly. It's kind of like when they use a word you don't want them using, like you curse and they copy you and they use a word, and I know a lot about this.
Right.
So then, I feel like it's almost counterproductive to say, you know, honey, it makes people really uncomfortable. They'll be like, really? That's awesome, you know?
What's a moment of discomfort in a grocery store, which could lead to
that's an excellent point.
Lifetime
right.
of being comfortable
healthy
with
education.
That? Exactly. Like, okay, it's uncomfortable in the grocery store for a minute. People either laugh or they're uncomfortable, but in the long run, this kid is comfortable with their body,
and then it might be worth that moment of discomfort. That is an excellent point. Look, believe me, I agree with the message here. I'm trying to communicate where some of the discomfort comes from, and I think, again, it's rooted in something that is deep and gets back to the earlier discussion we had about, like, general attitudes within Judaism and Orthodoxy, whatever, towards sexuality, about trying to sort of walk that line between its power and so on, but also in a particular context, and how does that become a message of being shameful?
No, I totally agree. I'm just going to cut forward to one topic we didn't touch on that I want to make sure with birth control.
Okay.
I want to. We have an issue. Discussion the issue of birth control. It's a complicated issue, obviously, right? Because parents don't want to think that their kids are going to become sexually active.
Right.
So I guess I feel like a parent has to make a decision about what their values are,
right.
And so they need to say to kids either. I really do not think you should be sexually active until you get married. However, if whatever, for whatever reason you decide you're going to be, I would ask that you come to me and or we figure out a way for you to get birth control. Like, I feel like that has to be talked about. Right. And the same thing with the boys. Do you know what I'm saying? Like, I don't think you should be sexually active, but if you're going to be sexually active. And so that's kind of a fine line. And I do get that that's a fine line, yeah. But I feel like that's an elephant in the room that kind of we need to address.
Right. I totally agree. And that, again, gets to that, like, how do you communicate this very nuanced and balanced message without erring on one side or the other? And a lot of people take the easy route out and they don't discuss it, therefore. I think it's important to go back to the point we made earlier, that in a way some of this, I guess, anxiety could be alleviated by the point that actually more information and more conversation usually leads to deferring sexual activity rather than having it come sooner. I do wonder if that's true in the Orthodox community, where there's such a strong ethos of no premarital sex. And with that ethos, that actually does a pretty good job at having people either defer it or actually wait till marriage. And then when the conversation is open, you shouldn't do it, but if you do, use this birth control. I mean, I don't think there are statistics whether that maybe makes it more of an option than it would have been otherwise. And that's certainly where people's anxiety is around that issue. But on the other hand, I mean, it's a serious health concern in terms of venereal diseases and unwanted pregnancies. So I think that we really, have a profound responsibility to our kids to figure out how to communicate that message correctly.
And then to follow through. Like, for example, if you say to a child, I don't really want you drinking at parties, but if you find that you're in a party where either everybody's drinking or you're drinking and you can't, I want you to call me, pick you up. I won't get angry, I'll come get you. But then you have to really not get angry when the kid calls them up. So it's sort of the same thing. If the girl comes to the mother and says, and I guess as a parent, what I would do is wait and see when they're in a more long-term relationship. I think I'd probably bring it up. I'd say, look, I don't know if you're sexually active. I personally think you should wait until you're married. But if you don't, honey, then try to be honest enough with yourself and with me so that we can get you the protection that you need.
Right. Also, I just think that maybe you're not going to like this, Dr. Marcus, but that also could be the role that a doctor plays in a child's life, that if a parent's not comfortable having this conversation with their child about birth control, to say, please be honest with your doctor, that's also a place you can talk about this. Because I know I've said this before, but I know of so many young women who have gone to the doctor and said they're not sexually active when they were sexually active because of the embarrassment. And it means that even the right people who are supposed to know, who could keep your secret or not feel like, shame you in that, because of the personal sense of shame, those people might be uncomfortable actually talking to a doctor about it. And that's a very different case than talking to your parent about it.
I love that, Rami. And not only do I love that, but I think the parent can help facilitate that. Like, if you feel like this is not a conversation you can have with your child, but you think that you might need to, the child may be thinking in this direction, then you can find a good doctor, a good OB who can talk to your child and say to the OB right from the start, like, I want you to be open. I want my daughter to feel open. I don't want you to have to tell me. Because, theoretically, doctors have to tell the parents, I think. The age of consent is until 18. Mm-hmm. But you can say, I am not going to ask any questions. You're going to talk to the doctor. And what happens between you and the doctor is what happens between you and the doctor. And I think that could be an incredibly powerful experience. And there are definitely OBs out there who really love, seeing adolescents and talking to adolescents and working this stuff through with adolescents. So I think it's a great idea.
Yeah. And I think to reiterate the point you said about the parent giving permission, so again, it doesn't become something shameful, right? It's like, I want you to know you can talk to me about anything. But if you would ever feel more comfortable, if there's things you can't talk to me about something, then you should really feel free to talk to the doctor and so on. So that giving of permission also makes it that it's not something that needs to be hidden and shameful.
It's also empowering. Like,
right.
Sex is an adult thing, and the mom doesn't or the dad, like the parent, does not have to be involved in that discussion. If you're making these adult decisions to have sex, which is an adult activity, then you can have a personal relationship with a doctor that doesn't involve a parent in it, because now's the time where you start to take responsibility for your body, and that might be an empowering message too.
Right. I think I would hazard parents. I think sometimes parents look for doctors. There are doctors who are very judgmental and very not helpful to kids because of their own values. And so, finding one of those doctors to kind of step in for you, I wouldn't recommend that. It's not going to work well.
So let me ask a follow-up question, which is, what about bringing in the rabbi? right? If you feel you have a rabbi that really can communicate a good message and a healthy message to say to the kid, that it goes back to your point, Rami, about Amarat. It goes back to the point about being empowering. I really think that that's such a powerful point. So, you know, saying like, you know, if you ever have some conflicts about these issues, you might want to talk to our rabbi about that.
If they have a relationship.
If they have a relationship.
Especially if your rabbi is teaching you Masachek Tubot. That rabbi should, you know, that conversation should happen, but that also that rabbi who's teaching that Masachet should be prepared to answer questions.
Well, absolutely. But I'm also saying that this gets to your point about sort of saying, like, respecting the child, you know, but also making the parents feel like I'm also giving them, like, you know, resources and Jewish messages and Torah messages as well, you know, so.
That's great. I think those are great. Okay.
Good.
Okay, thank you. Next, we will be talking to Dr. Joy Layden, but first, a word from one of our sponsors.
Erectile dysfunction can do a number on your sex life, your relationship, even your self-esteem, and male infertility could prevent you and your partner from being able to have kids. Maize Men's Sexual and Reproductive Health, headed by medical director Dr. Michael Werner, is a world leader specializing in treating ED and male infertility, very often with successful outcomes. If you're suffering with ED or fertility issues, call Dr. Werner at 646-380-2600. That's 646-380-2600 or visit maizemenshealth.com.
Hi, this is Sarah Levy, Public Relations and Events Assistant at Yeshiva Chovevei Torah Rabbinical School. Yeshiva Chovevei Torah Rabbinical School trains rabbis who are serving Klal Yisrael. We now have close to 100 rabbis in shuls, schools, and hillels throughout North America and in Israel, Europe, and Australia. This podcast is one of the many exciting projects of the Lindenbaum Center for Halachic Studies, which also publishes Teshuvot, Responsa, on issues facing the modern Orthodox community, and is currently running a summer fellowship on the Teshuvot of Rav Moshe Feinstein. To find out more about our Rabbi Smicha program or upcoming events, visit www.yctorah.org. In this and other areas, Yeshiva Chovevei Torah Rabbinical School is setting the standard in rabbinic education.
Our guest today is Dr. Joy Layden. Dr. Layden, Gottesman Professor of English at Yeshiva University, is the author of a memoir, National Book Award finalist of Through the Door, A Jewish Journey Between the Genders, and has written 7 books of poetry. In 2012, she was named as one of the Forward's 50 most influential or courageous Jews. Dr. Layden is the first openly transgender professor at an Orthodox institution. Dr. Layden, thank you so much for joining us on The Joy of Text.
Thank you for having me here.
Can you tell us a little bit about your journey in the Jewish community?
Well, I have really like 2 different kinds of journeys in the Jewish community. The first is just my own individual journey as a Jew, and it's as idiosyncratic as many non-Orthodox American Jews' stories are. My parents came from different kinds of Jewish backgrounds. They sort of averaged out to seeing being Jewish as more of an ethnicity with a few rituals thrown in than as a religious practice. But we were members of a synagogue, so I could go to Hebrew school, and the synagogue minyan was mostly composed of elderly Orthodox men from Eastern Europe. So I had an image of Jewish religious practice that I found very attractive, possibly even more attractive because I didn't understand what any of the men were saying. They were delighted that there was somebody under 70 who was there, and I was delighted that there was something in my white, middle-class, assimilated world that was as strange as I was. Judaism seemed to me to be a way of being different in the world that, unlike being trans, was valued, was okay, and connected me to other people. And I followed this kind of idiosyncratic, making my own Judaism up approach for most of my adult life. I would join synagogues, somewhat marginal. I really thought of Judaism as an individual spiritual practice primarily and only secondarily in terms of connection to community, because being in the closet, not actually being myself anywhere, it was hard for me to feel connected to any community. My assumption was that any community that knew who I really was would reject me. So that makes connection difficult. And even today, I feel that that's the weakest part of my Jewish identity, is I have very little sense of community and very little capacity for feeling part of a community. Those old habits of hiding and fear and feeling pre-rejected by everybody, they really have continued to mark me, although I'm trying to grow out of them. Once I returned to teaching at Stern as an openly transgender person, and the New York Post decided to put me on page 3 for what I think was entertainment value. I'm not sure that they really wanted to spark a discussion of gender identity in the Jewish world. But from that point, I started a different kind of a journey through the Jewish world, and one that has involved me getting to briefly meet and speak with a whole bunch of different kinds of Jewish communities around the U.S. And I have been astonished and delighted at the number of different, really different kinds of Jewish communities I found, and really impressed by the fact that no matter what these communities are like, what their religious practices or secularity is like, I meet people who are deeply committed to keeping Jewishness and Judaism alive and relevant. And, you know, they invite me because they want to include as many different kinds of Jews in their communities as possible. So that's a wonderful basis on which to meet them and to encounter their communities.
Can you tell us about the first day you stepped into Stern as Dr. Joy Layden?
Wow, that is that was one of the happiest days of my life. The New York Post piece had not come out yet. In fact, I was met by photographers as I was going to get my new ID, which I definitely needed, and I was so happy. It was it really felt like a dream come true. It was something that I had thought was impossible, and I felt that it was miraculous. So all of the normal bureaucratic stuff, like getting my ID picture taken, that was miraculous. Having an ID, showing it to security guards, everything was sort of bathed in this light of this incredible gift that I had been given. I was also struck by the fact that, so I'm walking around feeling like I'm bathed in the spotlight of the miraculous, right? Life at Yeshiva, but really all of life in New York is centered around the miracle of being able to teach as myself, is the way that it felt. But I was immediately struck by the fact that I wasn't noticed by anybody. Even people who had known me as a man didn't recognize me as a woman, which it's one of the strange things about gender transition. That means that you've successfully transitioned. But it also means that successfully transitioning at first means a real loss of connection and identity to other people. It's a peculiar thing, and it requires trans people to come out over and over again. So I was, you know, riding the elevator up past students who I'd had, and they were just looking away, because if you know somebody as one gender and then you see them presenting as another gender, it's actually like those silly Shakespeare comedies where people change their clothes and nobody recognizes them. Mm-hmm. You're like, oh, come on, this wouldn't possibly happen. But it does happen. We categorize the people we know. Like, gender is a fundamental way that we identify them. And it doesn't occur to people that, you know, that woman might be the person you know as a man. It doesn't work that way.
How long did it take you kind of to decide to actually make that transition? I mean, I'm sure that was, to a certain degree, you were deciding it your whole life. But from a concrete perspective, like, how was it years when you made the decision?
It was years. As you said, in some ways, it wasn't exactly my whole life, because it wasn't until, I mean, it was probably about 10, that I happened on an article in one of my mother's magazines. It was a women's magazine, so it was a tear-jerking piece about a mother talking about her son who had become her daughter. I didn't know there was anybody else like me, and I didn't know that there was a way to live as myself. I thought I needed some kind of magical, you know, as a kid, so you know, I thought there's magical processes or something would be necessary, but I really just didn't think that there was a way to do it. So from that point, I decided when I read that at age 10, oh, of course I'm going to do this. But in the practical sense, I was much too scared, because in day-to-day life, I believed that no one would love me or want to have anything to do with me if I dared to live as who I was. So I kept making, you know, I would have these crises through the years and kept making the decision over and over again, I just have to keep living as a man. It took a couple of years from the time that I really started to feel that I couldn't maintain living as a man, it was becoming too difficult. So much of my consciousness and energy was devoted to not being who I was. But I knew that if I transitioned, I would devastate my family. I would lose my marriage. My ex and I had been talking about this since we were sophomores in college, and she'd made it clear that she didn't mind that I felt like a woman. She's like, I don't know what that means. I'm a woman and I don't know what it means to feel like a woman, but you feel that way? That's fine, as long as you act and look like a man. She's a heterosexual woman. She can't, you know, live with somebody who doesn't look like a man. And so I accepted that bargain as long as I could. And I didn't want to lose my marriage. I didn't want to hurt my children and put them through the turmoil of divorce or gender transition. And so my original decision was whether I was going to transition or whether I was going to kill myself. At a certain point, that's what it became. And my first decision was, of course, I'm going to kill myself because it will be too awful for the people I love if I transition. And, you know, I'd spent my whole life in hiding on the assumption that I would become unlovable and monstrous if I actually became who I was. So it took several years of therapy and very difficult conversations with my wife and some growing as myself. I'd never tried to do anything to live my female gender identity. I didn't even know it was possible. So it took me a number of years before I finally said, all right, I'm not going to kill myself and I am going to live as myself.
Has it turned out any better than you thought?
It's turned out very differently than I thought. I think that this is common. My ideas about transition were frozen at this sort of childlike wish stage where you're either this or that. You know, somebody flips a switch and you're suddenly, you know, you were a boy, now you're a girl. It was this very black and white, all or nothing kind of thing. And so that meant that I couldn't imagine how difficult and complicated transition was. I didn't realize that it was not so much about, you know, learning to present myself as a woman as learning to be a person, to be an actual person, you know, learning to tell the truth and not hide myself all the time, figuring out who I was when I wasn't living in fear and hiding. One of the best things about transition was getting to tell the truth about myself. At first, I was drunk on it. I was like, oh, my God. You know, somebody asked me a question, and I don't have to hem and haw and, you know, edit things out, and I can just talk to them. It was the best thing. I think people who have grown up honest and truthful don't realize what a wonderful thing telling the truth is.
I'd like to go back to a point you made about how fundamental gender identity is in society, and, you know, to talk about the difference between what it means to be transgender and what it means to be gay. I mean, first of all, I assume people know this by now, but I think we should mention that transgender doesn't say something about whom you're sexually attracted. But the bigger issue is that, you know, I know that for gay people, they want to be known as gay, out of the closet, right, not hiding their identity. And I think it's what I'm hearing from you and what I've heard from others is there's some transgender people that don't want to be known as transgender. They're now true, you know, to the gender that they've always identified with, and they just want to be known in terms of that gender. So, but then, as you mentioned, you sort of lose the context that you had and the identity that you had before. I'm wondering if you could speak to that a little bit.
Some variation among transgender people. Mm-hmm. So you're absolutely right about both what's different about gender identity and sexual orientation, and also that neither most gay people nor most trans people want to have to hide who they are. Mm-hmm. For some, the term transgender includes a whole bunch of different relations to gender, many of them much more complicated than my relationship. You know, I'm a transsexual, so I was born and raised male, but I always identified as female. And so you don't need to really change the whole system of gender to move me from one slot to another. It's problematic, it creates disruptions, but it doesn't require us to, I don't need anybody to rethink what it means to be male or female. But transgender includes other kinds of people who would say they're neither male nor female, that those descriptions don't include them, or they would say that they're both male and female, or some people would say that they're gender fluid, so that means that they move around in different positions at different times. So I just wanted to make that clear, and I think that different relations to gender are just as different to me as they might be to you. I don't know them from the inside. I can only speak about my own little piece of the transgender world. Within that piece of the world, many transsexuals, just as you say, want to simply be known as the gender that they identify with. They have to go through a period of transition, but after that period of transition, they feel that the trans part of their lives, it's history, it's over.
Right. And I think something about this, you know, as you said, like in your case, it's very much maintaining our classic gender categories. I wonder if your sense is that that's actually easier in a religious sort of community to be transgender as opposed to being gay. Like in Iran, I think, right, somebody can be transgender, transsexual, but being gay or having gay sex is a crime. Because at least if you're transsexual, you're maintaining the classic heteronormative gender categories. And I'm sort of wondering, you know, if you have some sense about how that's played out for you in the Jewish community.
I think that definitely can be the case, although different religious communities put emphases on different things. So I'm not sure that example applies across the board. Most religious communities, most traditional communities, religious or non-religious, but most traditional communities find it difficult to include people who don't fit into the pre-established categories, whatever those might be. And so I'm not sure if you're, 6'4" and you're Iranian and you're transitioned from male to female, I'm not sure how well that goes, actually, in Iran. I don't know what those stories are like. But in my own experience, I do think that I've benefited greatly from being a fairly, my female gender identity is nothing spectacular. In fact, it fits in quite well at Stern. A lot of my fashion choices seem to be influenced by my students. Not all of them. And I wear long skirts. I don't wear pants. These are not for religious reasons, but this is the form of gender expression that feels right to me. And because I'm physically small, because really that's the single most important thing for a trans woman, male to female transsexual, is how tall are you? Because the taller you are, the harder it is for people to read you as female. Because I'm not that tall, I think it's easy for people to read me as female. And that has made an enormous difference. I don't know that I would have been allowed to return to teach at Stern or that I would have been able to if every time people looked at me, they saw gender dissonance. They saw somebody who looked, presenting as female but looked male or with some kind of combination. That, I think, is much more difficult for people than someone that you can sort of plug into one of the categories and read in conventional terms.
Dr. Layden, I have one more question, but I just want to say before that question, the first day I was in your class, I remember being obsessed with the boots you were wearing. I mean, it was an amazing class too, but I remember thinking, I love her boots. And then afterward, I had heard that there was a transsexual teacher in the English department, and I could not figure out who it was. And I remember going back like later in the week and Googling it and being very surprised at the class that I was taking. You were so female to me. I remember just thinking your outfit, your boots, and the class, it did not cross my mind until I actually looked it up.
That makes me so happy now.
I remember thinking, I love those boots.
What boots were they?
They were just these amazing black boots, but I remember thinking, they're so cute, but they would never fit over my calves because I have a hard time finding boots. Anyway, I wanted to ask, specifically in a Jewish institution, do you feel that the challenges that you've come across in transitioning have been unique in a Jewish institution? And if so, how someone who's in a Jewish institution or a Jewish community, what are those unique challenges and what can the community do to kind of accommodate those challenges or alleviate the already existing pressures that someone who's transitioning might feel within themselves?
That's a great question. I've only transitioned in one institution, but because I'm on the board of Kesha and because I'm in touch with other trans Jews, I'm familiar from the outside with some other kinds of situations. And I would say that they're are things that have been both uncommon about my situation at Stern and things that are very common. So most of the Jewish institutions, this is still true. There's been a lot of progress, but for the most part, Jewish institutions are really not sure what to do with trans people. My home synagogue in Western Massachusetts identifies as Reconstructionist. We've had a gay rabbi. They really were not well-equipped to have me transition. It's something that's unusual, it's outside of people's experiences, and institutional policies and even just social etiquette those things develop when situations come up over and over again. We tend not to deal well with the unique situation. So, you know, when I was told at first that I would never be able to teach at Stern because no one would accept me, it's very common for institutions of all kinds, Jewish and non-Jewish, to just not be able to imagine how this is going to work. It's never happened before. Maybe I'm okay with this, but what will other people think, right? How do we do this? And also, how do we do it without being completely defined and consumed by it? And it's also not uncommon for institutions, after a period of reflection, to figure something out. And I'm not exactly sure what Yeshiva University figured out. Maybe they figured out that a lawsuit was not what they needed. I think that they were strongly influenced by students of mine who told me that they were going to the dean. A number of my students surprised me by saying that they were outraged, not that an Orthodox institution would employ a transgender person, but that an Orthodox Jewish institution would treat a human being in the way that I was being treated by being excluded from campus. So that was completely unexpected by me, and I think it was unexpected by many of the administrators at Yeshiva University. I think there was an assumption that there would be a homogeneous range of response among students and their parents, and I kind of agreed with it. I'd spent my whole life assuming everybody would reject me if I ever came out as who I was, so I was not surprised by that. This, too, I think, is common, even in places that are liberal and progressive. I think there's a wide variety of individual responses and difficulties. So in those ways, I think my experience at Stern is common for Jewish institutions. One of the things that is particular to Yeshiva University is that it really does combine modernity and traditional Judaism in ways that are unusual. So it's really governed by secular law in certain kinds of ways, and also is trying to measure up to the standards of a secular academia. So it doesn't want to be seen as discriminatory. And it's also, of course, deeply committed to maintaining Orthodox Judaism and halakha. So when they invited me to come back, I don't know what combination of secular legal pressures, sense of Derech Eretz might have been going on there. But once I was there, they were in the position of allowing me to be there, right? So an openly transgender person can be in the Orthodox world. That was groundbreaking, but they couldn't talk about it because the institution couldn't risk doing anything that would make it seem that, contrary to orthodoxy, that they approved of and supported transgender identity. They just, you know, they could not say anything one way or the other. And in a way, that made it the safest place in the world to be an openly transgender person. Nobody who had a problem with my identity would say anything to me, either out of Derech Eretz, personal respect, which I think is a marvelous part of Orthodox Jewish culture, or out of fear of a lawsuit. But either way, I was safe from people who had difficulties with my identity, but I was also isolated. No one could talk about it. So you were sitting in my classroom liking my boots, and I was definitely standing up there thinking, I wonder who knows what about me. You know, how many of the people here are seeing me as a man in a skirt? How many people here are seeing me as a woman? I don't know. You can't ask people. I mean, it's pretty disruptive to relationships, and it's pedagogically irresponsible to do that to students. That's not what you guys were there to talk about. But it's very disorienting to really not know in this fundamental way how people see you. And because the institution can't talk about it, it's been very difficult for the institution to grow as an institution in its relationship to this. What are the problems? What are the issues? Who thinks what here? What needs do we have to accommodate? Those things are being worked out, but they're being worked out in silence. And that is not uncommon also at Jewish institutions. You know, we let people who are openly different be here. We'll be tolerant of them. We're not going to kick them out or abuse them. But we can't, you know, feel uncomfortable. We don't really want to talk about this difference. And we're not sure whether we don't want to talk about it because it embarrasses us or because we don't want to embarrass them. But either way, maybe the best thing is to just pretend like nothing has happened.
Mm-hmm. You know, it's so funny. The segment before this is talking to your kids about sex. And I feel like we're making the same point there. Like, you're not sure if you're not talking about it because it's going to embarrass you or them. But in general, we'll just not talk about it.
Yes.
The Forward recently has been running a whole series on transgender people, I think even transgender rabbis in the Jewish community. Have you taken note of that? Do you feel that somehow the conversation has been opening up and changing around that?
Absolutely. The Forward has done a lot of work around that. They even published a little booklet of those articles called Transgender and Jewish. Mm-hmm. And there are many great things. The people that they've portrayed in there and the way they've portrayed them has been marvelous. But one of my favorite things about that book project and the series was I didn't know about it. So for a couple of years, it felt like whenever anybody was thinking about transgender identity and Jewish identity together, I was the person that they thought of. I was the one who popped up in Google searches. But when that Forward did that, they deliberately wanted to broaden the conversation. They didn't want the Jewish community to think of trans Jews as all one person, you know, all one face, all one kind of life, all one kind of relation to Judaism. And so they reached out and they found amazing people, amazing Jews of many different kinds. I think that that was a great step forward.
So you lost your role as a poster child.
I did. My Caitlyn Jenner moment passed.
Right.
Bathing suit.
Uh-huh, exactly. I have one last question, which is, I wonder how much the halacha is a part of it and how much it's really more about communal acceptance. You know, as a rabbi, I get questions, halachic questions about transgender people. What side of the mechitza do they sit on? Can they do this? Can they do that? And those questions obviously have to be answered, but I'm wondering, I know that, you know, you go to a Reconstructionist synagogue, but I'm wondering how, if you have a sense of the interplay between the halachic aspect and the communal aspect.
I think that there's a very strong interrelationship. One of the great innovations that the Torah makes, you know, Judaism is a religious mutation in the Iron Age. There hasn't really been anything like it. And one of the innovations is the idea of the sacred community, that you make God visible in the world by making the whole community sacred. It's a very democratic idea. It's really not the way that religions worked in the Iron Age. It was the high priests and the kings, you know, the aristocracy did the religious stuff. You know, there are many advantages to that, and I think, you know, obviously halacha has grown in ways that make it look very different than the original Mosaic codes, but that idea of sacred community is alive and well in halacha, and there are, as I say, there are many advantages to it, but one of the problems that comes up is that in a sacred community, it can be difficult to distinguish between norms that are sacred and norms that just feel like they're sacred because they're part of a community that's sacred. So I heard of, this is not somebody I talked to, this was something that someone else told me, so maybe it's apocryphal, I don't think so, it was a reliable source, but it made sense. Somebody told me that an Orthodox rabbi had told them that they would not allow someone with Tourette's syndrome to daven in the synagogue, not because it's a sin to have Tourette syndrome, but because it would be disruptive to the work of Avodah. So having somebody who is different in a way that disrupts the communal kavanah is antithetical to the work of the sacred community. And once you start saying that, it turns out because communities are based on norms, social norms that have nothing to do with divine intervention, all communities are based on those norms, and all communities get upset when people break those norms. At least at first, people can get used to things. But once you say, you know, anyone who disturbs the community by being obviously different really can't be in the community, that's when that fusion of the sacred and the communal becomes very problematic to LGBT people, but also it can be problematic for people with disabilities, for Jews of color, because the community now has a religious reason for closing itself off to people who are different. And within the community, it means that people become afraid to show their differences. So I think that all Orthodox communities probably have a greater range of variation than many people are aware of, because there are strong pressures to be as normative as possible. And again, that's the way the communities work. But when those pressures to be normative are fused with religious significance, it can become devastating to people, but also can blind communities to actually how many different kinds of people they already welcome, which can make it even more difficult to accommodate new differences. Does that make sense?
Yes, great. Yeah. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Dr. Leiden, for joining us. We really appreciate all of your insights.
Thank you. That's a wonderful conversation.
Next up, we'll answer a listener question, but first, a word from our sponsors.
Hi, I'm Jillian, an intern at JOFA. The Joy of Text is sponsored by JOFA, the Jewish Orthodox Feminist Alliance. Enjoying the podcast? Dr. Batsheva Marcus and Rabbi Dov Linzer continue this conversation on JOFA's website, where they answer more of your questions about sexuality, relationships, and halacha in the form of a blogcast. Visit www.jofa.org/blogcast to read the full conversation. The Joy of Text is generously supported by Targum Shlishi, a Raquel and Aryeh Rubin Foundation.
Our question is, I'm an Orthodox Jewish man who is autogenophilic, which means I'm sexually aroused by the thought or image of myself as a woman. This has no bearing on my gender identity and is more akin to a fetish, though many autogenophiliacs do physically transition because of it. I identify as male and present as fairly masculine. From a very young age, I can recall instances of arousal at people's accounts in children's stories involving any sort of male-to-female gender transformation. I began to have persistent gender fantasies of myself becoming aesthetically or anatomically female before puberty, which elicited strong feelings of guilt on my part. Although I'm attracted to women, I also happen to be asexual, and so these fantasies are much more arousing and enjoyable than normal sexual fantasies, which I do not have. While I have never cross-dressed, both due to my disinterest in the biblical and the biblical prohibition, many autogenophiliacs do. The prospect certainly arouses me. I do, however, enjoy transgender-themed erotica. I have told several close friends about this, and I fully intend to tell any future romantic partner simply because it informs my sexuality to such a great extent.
Well, that's a really interesting question, and I think it just brings up the whole issue of fetishes.
What's the question, by the way?
The question is, I think the question is, like, what does halacha say about this and how am I supposed to handle it? Is that a fair?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I hear that as a question, too.
I mean, that's what I... So I would say this would be almost a perfect place where fantasy would be incredibly helpful to you. And I do think that more people out there have fantasies that are unusual or different than many people. And just because your fantasies are not typical of what, or very normal, you know, if you go out to the public and you have, you know, 50% of the population fantasizing A, everybody else falls into a 5 to 10%, that doesn't mean that you are asexual because this is what turns you on as opposed to this is what turns you on. So just be thankful and appreciative that there's something that turns you on. It's not something that's harmful. It's not something that you're going to hurt anybody with. I would say use it in fantasies. I'll let Rebbe Linzer talk about the dressing up issue because obviously that doesn't really hurt anybody either. And if, let's say, you're in a relationship and the person you're with is okay with that, you know, that helps your sex life with them. Is that acceptable? But it would seem like the more you can kind of embrace it, accept this is who you are, and use it to create a loving, meaningful relationship with another person, that's the best you can do.
Wow. So this raises a lot of issues. I will start with the dressing up, although it seems like he hasn't done that, but he's considering that. I mean, I think it's also an interesting question about dressing up, you know, as part of a fantasy, or just husband and wife, and cross-dressing, because there's a biblical prohibition about, you know, man can't wear woman's clothes, woman can't wear man's clothes. On the other hand, on Purim, sometimes people cross-dress, and it's already discussed in the Ramah about this, and he says it's allowed because you're not really trying to be present genuinely as the other gender. Gets back to a discussion about transgender, but we'll bracket that for now. So first of all, that's fascinating because, you know, normally we don't interpret biblical prohibitions based on just assuming that they are a particular context and in a different context they're allowed. But I think it would certainly apply, for example, if we were talking about costumes. If people want to get, sometimes people buy costumes for dress up, and if it's clearly a costume and not genuinely dressing like the other thing, then I don't think that that would be a problem. It's an interesting question about, I'm not trying to present to other people as this other gender, but I'm really wearing clothes. It's not a costume, and I really, at least for myself, want to be feeling or dressing like that other gender. I think it does really raise very serious questions in terms of that biblical prohibition, and I have to give that some more serious thought. So that's one point. In terms of the issue, the other thing that I hear, though, is like, if he's talking about eventually being in a relationship with a woman and using these types of thoughts or this type of dress up, assuming that it can be done in a halachically acceptable way, then I don't see that as a problem. Then that gets to issues that we've talked about. Any types of fantasies or dress up or any type of activity that can turn you on, as long as it's part of relating to the person in front of you, is totally fine. If this person it's sounding like is really thinking maybe about being more solitary and having these types of thoughts and fantasies and dress up as a way of turning himself on, you know, then it gets to minimally related to issues around masturbation and arousal and sexual thoughts that are not in a relationship between a husband and wife in a committed relationship. And so it would tap into those problems, but I don't see it being something unique or distinctive because of the nature of those fantasies.
I realize this is probably a bigger question and we maybe should address another time, but as I'm listening to you, I'm thinking, you know, we have no idea the age or whatever of this guy who's writing in. He could be 30. Mm-hmm. So if he's 30 and he's not in a relationship and so he has no sexuality outside of himself, do we then kind of burden him with a life with no sexual activity? And that's a bigger question, and maybe we should just table
it. Yeah, it's a bigger question, you know, and it, I was sort of thinking about those issues as well and thinking about, because, for example, the thought that I had is, it came up with issues of pornography in general about sexual thoughts that we tend to focus on a problem in the male context of masturbation. But there's also Gemara that says thoughts of sin, and particularly talking about sexual sin, are worse than the sin itself. Hiruei aveira kashim aveira. Now, obviously, that's a rhetorical and exaggerated statement, but partly that might mean because we're afraid of where it's going to lead. And it could be other aspects as well. And when this person talks about, well, I fantasize about dressing up, does that mean it's going to lead to dressing up? And is dressing up, you know, if that's a biblical prohibition, how are we going to deal with that? So to some degree, there's the factual question, which we've discussed in many contexts, does thinking about these things translate into action? But I was wondering the same question you were asking, which is, if this person can't get stimulated in other ways, and let's at least say that it is about together with him and his wife, then I don't think we can worry in that context about, oh, maybe thinking about dressing up will lead to him doing some other sin. I think that there we have to focus on, look, this is the only way he can have a sexual relationship and, you know, to his wife and connect in this way. So we have to, you know, not worry about where these thoughts might go. But in your case, where basically he might never have a relationship with another person, yeah, that raises some serious questions that need more thought.
And we'll have to address them in a future podcast.
I guess so.
Okay, thank you. If you have any questions for the show, you could submit them anonymously at www.thejoyoftext.org. Thank you to Dr. Joy Layden. The Joy of Text is produced by Jewish Public Media, which is supported in part by a grant from Next and Natan. This episode was recorded by Mike Hurst and edited by David Svi Kalman. You can listen to the show on iTunes, Stitcher, SoundCloud, or with any podcast app. My name is Rami Smith. Thank you so much for listening.